down the bumpy road toward the street. I parked out in front of the Burke's half-darkened house. When Lita answered my knock, I was standing with the decrepit leather case dangling off the end of my screwdriver, like the skin of some strange beast. Tonight her midriff was bare. Here it was the middle of February, and she was wearing an outfit that might have been suitable for a belly dancer. Wrap-around sarong-style pants with wide legs in a thin floral fabric reminiscent of summer pajama bottoms. The top was a similar fabric, different print, with no sleeves and one button appearing right between her quite weensy breasts. I said, "Is J.D. here?" She shook her head.
"He's not home yet."
"Mind if I come in?" I pictured her playing dumb, a reaction ranging anywhere from denial to duh. She looked at me and she looked at the leather case, apparently unable to think of a thing to say except, "Oh." She stepped back from the door, and I went into the darkened hall, following as she led the way toward the kitchen at the rear. A glance to the left showed Jack, the sticky-fingered toddler, lying in a stupor on the couch, watching a cartoon video. The infant slept, slumped sideways in a well-padded portable car seat, while colored images flickered across its face. The kitchen still smelled like the sautéed onions and ground beef from dinner on Monday, which seemed like ages ago. Some of the dishes piled in the sink looked the same, too, though several other meals' worth had been piled on top. She was probably the type who waited until everything was used before she ventured into the washing process.
"You want some coffee?"
she asked. I could see a fresh pot on a Mr. Coffee stand, the mechanism still spitting out the last few drops.
"That'd be nice," I said.
I sat down at the banquette and checked the kitchen table for sticky spots. I found a clear couple of inches and propped my elbow with care. She took down a mug and filled it, then refilled hers before she put the pot back on the machine. In profile, her nose seemed too long for her face, but the effect in certain lights was lovely nonetheless. Her neck was long and her ears elfin, her short-cropped dark hair trimmed to wisps around her face. Her eyes were lined in smudged black, and her lip gloss was a brownish tint. I put the leather case in the middle of the table. She took a seat on the bench, pulling her feet up under her. She ran her hand through her hair, her expression somewhat sheepish.
"I kept meaning to take that out, but I never got around to it. What a dork."
"You installed surveillance equipment?"
"Wasn't much, just a mic and a tape recorder."
"Why?"
"I don't know. I was worried," she said. Her dark eyes seemed enormous, filled with innocence.
"I'm listening." Color was rising in her face.
"I thought J.D. and Lorna might be fooling around, but I was wrong."
There was a baby bottle half full of formula sitting on the table. She unscrewed the nipple and used the contents for cream. She offered me some, but I declined.
"What was it, voice activated?" "Well, yeah. I know it sounds kind of dumb in retrospect, but I just found out I was pregnant with a baby, and I was throwing up all day. Jack wasn't even out of diapers, and I was frantic about J.D. I knew I was being bitchy, but I couldn't help myself. I looked horrible and felt worse, and there was Lorna, slim and elegant. I'm not stupid. I figured out what she did for a living, and so did he. J.D. started finding excuses for going back there every other day. I knew if I confronted him, he'd laugh in my face. So I borrowed some of Daddy's stuff."
"Were they having an affair?"
Her expression was self-mocking. "He fixed her toilet. One of her screens had come loose, and he fixed that, too. The most he ever did was complain about me, and even that wasn't bad. She had a fit and chewed him out. She said he had a hell of a nerve when I was the one doing all the suffering and hard work. Also, she got on him because he didn't lift a finger with Jack. That's when he started cooking, which has been a big help. I feel bad I never thanked her, but I wasn't supposed to know she'd come to my defense."
"How'd you know how to install the bug?"
"I've watched Daddy do it. Lorna was gone a lot, so it wasn't hard. The doorbell never worked, but the box was there. I just drilled a hole in the floor and then crawled under the cabin. All I had to do was make sure the tape was close enough to the edge of the porch so I could switch it without a hassle. We kept the gardening tools under there. Any time I weeded, I would find a way to check the tape.
How many tapes did you run?
I only used one tape, but the first time was a bust because the mic was defective and didn't pick up half the time. Second try was better, but the sound was distorted, so you couldn't hear too well. She had the radio on. She played this jazz station all the time. Up front, there's this little fragment with her and J.D. I had to listen three times to be sure it was him. Then her drying her hair. That was entertaining. I got her end of a couple of phone calls, that whole business where she's cranking on J.D. Then more music, only country this time. Then she's talking to some guy. That part's left over from the first round, I think.
Did you tell the police?
There wasn't anything to tell. Besides, I was embarrassed, she said. I didn't want J.D. to know I didn't trust him, especially when it turned out he's innocent. I felt like a fool. Plus, the whole thing's illegal, so why incriminate myself? I'm still worried they'll start thinking it was J.D. who killed her. It scared me silly when you started in on us, but at least this way I can prove the two of them were friends and got along okay. I stared at her.
Are you trying to tell me you still have the tapes?
Well, sure, but there's only one, she said. The first time was mostly static, so I went ahead and taped over it.
You mind if I listen?
You mean right now?
If you don't mind.
Chapter 15. She unfolded herself and got up from the table. She moved out into the hallway and disappeared from sight. Moments later, she returned with an empty cassette box and a little tape recorder, the cassette already in place and visible through the oval window. I guess I didn't have to keep this, but it made me feel better. Really, J.D. couldn't have killed her because he wasn't even in town. He took off Friday morning on a fishing trip. She wasn't killed until Saturday when he was miles away.
Where were you that day?
I was gone, too. I decided to go part of the way with him. He took me as far as Santa Maria and dropped Jack and me at my sister's on Friday. I spent a week with her and then came home on the bus.
You have any objections to giving me her name and number?
You don't believe me?
Let's don't get into that, Lita. You're not exactly a Girl Scout, I said.
Well, I know, but that doesn't mean I'd kill anyone.
What about J.D.? Can he verify his whereabouts?
You can ask my sister's husband, Nick. That's who he went to Nacimiento with.
I made a note of the name and number.
Lita punched the play button on the recorder. After a brief interval of white noise, the sound seemed to jump out. The reception was dismal, filled with clunks and banging as people moved around. With the equipment so close, the knocking on the door sounded like lightning cracks. A chair scraped, and someone thunked across the floor.
Oh, hi. Come on in. I got the check right here.
There were a couple of inaudible remarks between the two of them. The front door closed like a muffled explosion, footsteps clunking.
How's Lita feeling?
She's kind of down in the dumps, but she was this way last time. She gets to feeling fat and ugly. She's convinced I'm going out to screw around on her, so she busts out crying every time I leave the house.
I put out a hand. Hold on a minute. That's J.D.'s voice? She pushed pause, and the recording stopped.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to recognize. I had to play it two or three times myself. You want to hear it again?
If you don't mind, I said.
I've never heard Lorna's voice, but I'm assuming you can identify her as well.
Well, sure, Lita said.
She punched the rewind button. When the tape stopped, she pressed play, and we listened to the opening again.
Oh, hi. Come on in. I got the check right here.
Again, muffled remarks between the two of them, and the front door closed like a sonic boom. Footsteps clunking.
How's Lita feeling?
She's kind of down in the dumps, but she was this way last time. She gets to feeling fat and ugly. She's convinced I'm going out to screw around on her, so she busts out crying every time I leave the house.
Lorna was saying,
What's her problem? She looks darling.
Well, I think so, but she's got some girlfriend that happened to.
Footsteps thunked across the floor, and a chair scraped back, sounding like a lion roaring in the jungle.
She only gained 15 pounds with Jack. How could she feel fat? She doesn't even show.
My mother gained 46 with me. Now that's uggers. I've seen pictures. stomach hanging down to here, boobs like footballs, and her legs looked like sticks.
Laughter, mumbles, static.
Yeah, well, it isn't real, so you can't talk her out of it. You know how she is,
mumble, mumble.
Insecure.
That's what you get for hooking up with someone half your age.
She's 21.
Serves you right. She's an infant. Listen, you want me to keep Jack while you two go out to dinner?
More mumbles.
XXXXXXXX.
The response here was completely missing, blotted out by static.
Problem. He and I get along great. In exchange, you can do me a favor and fog the place for me next time I go out of town. The spiders are getting out of control.
Thanks. Receipt in your mailbox.
Chairs scraping. Clump, clump of footsteps crossing the cabin. Muffled voices. The conversation continued outside and then stopped abruptly. Silence. When the tape picked up again, there were strains of country music with the high whine of a hairdryer running over it. A phone began to ring. The hairdryer was turned off. Clump, clump, clump of footsteps like a series of gunshots. The phone was picked up, and Lorna raised her voice in greeting. After that, much of her end of the call was a series of short responses.
Uh-huh. Sure. Right. Okay.
That's great.
There was a fragmentary mention of the palace that made me think she might be talking to Danielle. Hard to tell with the competing strains of country music overlaid. There was a second conversation between J.D. and Lorna, which was much as Lita indicated. J.D. complained, and Lorna chewed him out because he never helped at home. Lita pressed the stop button impatiently.
It goes on like that. Pissed me off the way they were always talking about me behind my back. A lot of the rest is just mumbling, and most you can't even hear.
Too bad, I said.
Yeah, well, the equipment was kind of dinky. I didn't want to get into anything elaborate because it was too much trouble. The amplification was minimal. You get a lot of distortion that way.
When was this done? Any way to pin down the date?
Not really. Lorna sat with Jack a couple of different times, but I never wrote it down. It wasn't any special occasion, just us popping out for a bite to eat. With a toddler at home, an hour by yourself feels like heaven.
What about the month? It must have been early in the pregnancy, because he mentions you're not showing yet. And wasn't there mention of a receipt? In that first conversation, it sounds like he stopped by to pick up the rent.
Oh, maybe so. You could be right about that. I mean, Jeremy was born in September, so that must have been, I don't know, April sometime? She paid the first of the month.
When did you start the taping?
Around then, I guess. Like I said, the first tape was all static. This is the second one I did. I think he actually had the exterminator out for all the spiders and bugs. He probably has a record of it if you want me to look it up.
What else is on here?
Mostly junk, like I said. The batteries went dead about halfway through, and after that all you hear is the stuff still on there from the first time I taped.
She pulled the tape out and tucked it back in the empty cassette box. She got up from the table as if to leave the room. I caught her casually by the arm.
Mind if I take that?
She hesitated.
What for? So I can hear it again.
She made a face.
I don't know. I don't think that's a good idea. This is the only one I got.
I'll bring it back as soon as possible. She shook her head.
I'd rather not. Come on, Lita. What are you so worried about?
How do I know you won't turn it over to the cops?
Oh, right. So they can listen to people clump around making small talk? This is not incriminating stuff. They're talking about the fucking bugs, I said. Besides, you can always claim you had permission. Who's going to contradict you?
She gave that consideration.
What's your interest? I was hired to do this. This is my job, I said. Look, from what you've said, this tape was made within a month of Lorna's death. How can you be sure it's not significant?
You'll bring it right back?
I promise.
Reluctantly, she put the cassette on the table and pushed it over to me.
But I want to know where to call in case I need it back, she said.
You're a doll, I said.
I took out a business card and made a note of my home phone and my home address.
I gave you this before, but here it is again. Oh, and one more thing.
Sounding crabby, she said,
What?
Every time I manipulate people, it seems to make them so cross.
Has J.D. come into any money in the last few months?
J.D. doesn't have money. If he does, he never told me.
You want me to ask when he gets in?
It's not important, I said. Anyway, if you mention it, you might have to tell him what we were talking about, and I don't think you want to do that.
From the expression on her face, I thought maybe I could trust her discretion. I stopped at a mini-mart on the way back to my place. Somewhere I had a tape recorder, but the batteries were probably dead. While I was at it, I bought myself a king-size cup of coffee and a nasty-looking meat sandwich wrapped in cellophane. From the pink stuff peeking out the side, it was hard to imagine what cow part this was thin slivers of. I ate driving home, feeling too starved to wait. It was not quite 8 o'clock, but this was probably lunch. Home again, I spent some time getting organized. The tape recorder was right where it was supposed to be, in the bottom drawer of my desk. I changed the batteries and found the headphones, a pencil, and a legal pad. I played the tape through, listening with my eyes closed, the headphones pressed against my ears. I played the tape back again, taking notes this time. I transcribed what I could hear clearly and left a series of dots, dashes, and question marks where the sound was garbled or inaudible. It was slow going, but I finally reached a point where I'd gleaned as much as I could. As Lita had indicated toward the end of the tape, after 60 minutes of boring talk, her machine had gone dead, leaving a fragment from the first taping she'd done. The one voice was Lorna's. The other voice was male, but not J.D.'s, as far as I could tell. There was a segment of country music playing on the radio. Lorna must have turned it off because the silence was abrupt and punctuated by static. The guy spoke up sharply, saying, "Hey!" Lorna sounded annoyed. "I hate that stuff." XXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXX it's XXXXXXX. She goes in XXXXXXX day XXX.
God damn it. Would you stop saying that? You're really sick.
People shouldn't XXXXXXX. Clatter, clink, sound of water, squeaking, XXXXX, thump, thump.
I'm serious. By
XX, laughter, chair scrape, rustle, murmur.
There was something quarrelsome in the tone, an edginess in Lorna's voice. I played the tape twice more, writing down everything I heard clearly, but the subject of the conversation never made any sense.
I took the headphones off. I pinched the bridge of my nose and rubbed my hands across my face. I wondered if the guys in the forensics lab had a way to amplify sound on a tape like this. As a private investigator, I was not exactly into high-tech equipment. A portable typewriter was about as state-of-the-art as I could boast. The problem was, I didn't see how I could ask for police assistance without an explanation of some kind. Despite my assurances to Lita, she was guilty of withholding, if not evidence, then information that might have been relevant to the police investigation. Cops get very surly when you least expect it, and I didn't want them to take an interest in something that wasn't mine to begin with. Who else did I know? I tried the yellow pages in the telephone book under audio. The businesses listed offered laser home theaters, giant screen TVs, custom design and installation of audio systems, and presentation graphics, followed by the ads for hearing aids, hearing evaluations, and speech therapists. I tried the section entitled Sound, which was devoted in large part to designing wireless drive-through intercoms and residential and commercial sound systems. Oh. I checked my watch. 9:15. I flipped back to the white pages under KSPL and called Hector Moreno at the local FM station. It was probably too early to reach him, but I could at least leave a message. The phone was picked up after 3 rings.
K-Spell, this is Hector Moreno.
Hector, I can't believe it's you. This is Kinsey Milhone. Aren't you there awfully early?
Well, hey, how are you? I switch shifts now and then. Keeps me from getting bored. What about you? What are you up to?
I have a tape recording with very poor sound quality. Would you have any way to clean it up?
That depends on what you got. I could try, he said. You want to drop it off? I can leave the door unlocked.
I'll be right there. En route, I made a stop at Rosie's, where I told her about Beauty and begged for doggy bones. Earlier, she'd boiled up 2 pounds of veal knuckle for the stock she makes. I had to pick through the trash to get them, but she wrapped 2 in paper with the usual admonishment.
You should get a dog, she said.
I'm never home, I replied. She is always on me about this. Don't ask me why.
Just a piece of aggravation, in my opinion. I took the packet of bones and began to back away, hoping to curtail discussion.
A dog is good company, and protection, too.
I'll think about it, I said as the kitchen door swung shut.
Get a fellow while you're at it.
At the station, I let myself in. Hector had left the door ajar and the foyer lights on. I went down into the twilight of the stairwell with my paper packet of bones. Beauty was waiting for me when I reached the bottom. She was the size of a small bear, her dark eyes bright with intelligence. Her coat was red-gold, the undercoat puffy and soft. When she saw me, her fur seemed to undulate, and she emitted a low, humming growl. I watched her lift her head at the scent of me. Without warning, she pursed her lips and howled, a soaring note of ululation that seemed to go on for minutes. I didn't move, but I could feel my own fur bristle in response to her keening. I was rooted to the bottom step, my hand on the rail. Something primitive in her singing sent ice down along my spine. I heard Hector call her, then the quick thump of his crutches as he swung along the corridor.
Beauty, he snapped.
At first she refused to yield. He called her again. Her eyes rolled back at him reluctantly, and I could see her debate. She was willful, intent. As strong as her urge toward obedience, she didn't want to comply. Her complaints were sorrowful, the half-talk of dogs in which sentiment is conveyed in the insistent language of canines. She howled again, watching me. I murmured, "What's the matter with her?"
"Beats me."
"I brought her some bones."
"It's not that."
He leaned down and touched her. The howling became a low cry, filled with such misery that it broke my heart. He held his hand out. I passed him the packet of veal knuckles. Hector looked at me oddly.
"You smell like Lorna. Have you been handling something of hers?"
"I don't think so. Just some papers," I said. "There was a scarf of hers in the banker's box, but that was yesterday."
"Sit down very carefully on the steps where you are."
I eased myself down into a sitting position. He began to talk to Beauty, his tone full of comfort. She watched me with a mixture of hope and confusion, thinking I was Lorna, knowing I was not. Hector offered her the bones, which failed to interest her. Instead, carefully, she extended her blunt snout and sniffed at my fingers. I could see her nostrils work as she sifted and analyzed the components of my personal scent. He scratched her ears, massaging her meaty shoulders. Finally, she seemed to accept that she had erred somehow. She hung her head, watching me with puzzlement, as if at any minute I might turn into the woman she was waiting for. Hector straightened up.
"She's okay now. Come on, here. Why don't you take these?" he said, passing the bones back to me. "She might decide she likes you yet."
I followed him into the same small studio. Beauty had resumed her wary guardianship, and she positioned herself between the two of us. She put her head down on her feet. Occasionally she gave me a look, but she was clearly depressed. Hector had made fresh coffee, which he offered from a jug thermos sitting on the counter beside a cardboard box and a leather photo album. I let him pour me a cup, figuring I couldn't feel much worse. He perched up on his stool, and I watched while he phased out the jazz number that was playing. He extemporized a commentary, feigning casual knowledge from the liner notes in the CD. His voice was deep and melodious. He slipped in another cassette, adjusted the sound levels, and then turned to me.
"Let's try the bones," he said. "Beauty needs a lift, poor girl."
"I feel bad," I said. "I was wearing those jeans when I went through Lorna's files." I opened the paper packet and hunkered next to Beauty. He coached me through the process. She finally relented, allowing me to stroke her densely furred head. She took one of the knuckle bones between her feet and licked it thoroughly before she tested with her teeth. She made no particular objection when I rose again and perched up beside Hector on a second stool. Hector, meanwhile, was sorting through a stack of old black-and-white photographs with white fluted rims. He had a box of gummed corners and was mounting selected snapshots in an album fat with photographs.
"What are those?" "My dad's got a birthday coming up, and I thought he'd get a kick. Most of these were taken during World War II."
He passed me a snapshot of a man in pleated pants and a white dress shirt, standing in front of a microphone.
"He was 42. He tried to enlist, but Uncle Sam turned him down. Too old, bad feet, punctured eardrum. He was already working as an announcer at radio station WCPO in Cincinnati, and they told him they needed him for the war effort. Keep morale up here at home. He used to take me with him. Probably how I got the bug."
He set the album aside.
"Let's see what you have."
I took the cassette from my bag and passed it over to him. "Someone was doing a little eavesdropping. I'd rather not say who." He turned it over in his hand.
"I probably can't do much with this. I was hoping you were talking 8 or multitrack. Know how this works?"
"Not at all," I said.
"This is Mylar ribbon, coated on one side with a bonding material containing iron oxide. Signal passes through a coil and a recording head, and that causes a magnetic field to form between the poles of the magnet. Iron particles get magnetized in something called domains." "No point in boring you to death," he said. "The point is, professional recording equipment is going to give you far better fidelity than a little tape like this. What was it, some kind of little dingus running off batteries?"
"Exactly. There's a lot of ambient noise, mumbling and static. You can't hear half of it."
"Doesn't surprise me. What did you use for playback? Same thing?"
"Probably the equivalent," I said. "I gather you can't help."
"Well, I can put it on my machine at home and see if that gives you anything. If the sound wasn't laid down in the first place, there's never going to be a way to pick it up on playback. But I got good speakers and could maybe filter out some frequencies. Play around with bass and treble and see what that does."
I pulled out the notes I'd made. "This is what I picked up so far. Anything I couldn't hear, I left blank with a question mark."
"Can you leave the tape with me? I can take a crack at it when I get home tonight and call you sometime tomorrow."
"I'm not sure about that. I swore I'd guard it with my life. I'd hate having to admit I left the tape with you."
"So don't tell. Someone asks for it back, just give me a call and come pick it up."
"You're a very devious person, Hector."
"Aren't we all?"
He took the page of notes I'd made and went into the other room to make a copy while I waited. I gave him my business card with my home address and phone jotted on the back. By the time I left the studio, Beauty had apparently decided I was part of her pack, though much lower in the pecking order and therefore in need of protection. She very kindly walked me to the stairwell, matching her footsteps to mine, and watched as I went up the steps and out into the foyer. I peeked back and found her still standing there, looking up, her gaze fixed on mine. I said, "Good night, Beauty." Pulling out of the KSPL parking lot, I caught a glimpse of a lone man on a bike streaking across the intersection. He took the corner wide and disappeared from sight, reflectors on his spokes making circles of light. For a moment I could feel a mounting roar in my ears, darkness gathering at the edges of my vision. I rolled down the window and pulled fresh air into my lungs. A wave of clamminess climbed my frame and passed. I pulled into the empty intersection and slowed, peering right, but there was no sign of him. The street lamps receded in a series of diminishing uprights that narrowed to a point and vanished. I headed down to Lower State Street, cruising Danielle's turf. I needed company, or a good night's sleep, whichever came first. If I found Danielle, maybe the two of us would buy champagne and orange juice, drink a toast to Lorna just for old time's sake. Then I'd head for home. I pulled into the parking lot at Neptune's Palace and got out of my car. From the far end of the parking lot, the noise level was considerably louder than I'd experienced before. The crowd was boisterous. The side doors were opened onto the parking lot, and a knot of revelers had spilled out. Some guy toppled sideways, taking two women with him. The three of them lay on the asphalt, laughing. This was Thursday night trade, nearly manic in its energy, everyone determined to party, gearing up for the coming weekend. Music pounded against the walls. Cigarette smoke drifted on the frigid night air in wisps and curls. I heard the shattering of glass, followed by maniacal laughter, as if a genie had been released. I caught sight of a patrol car in the parking lot. The black and whites usually come down here every couple of hours. The beat officer parks and works his way through the place in search of liquor violations and petty criminals. I steeled myself and pushed through the door. I traveled the length of the bar like a fish swimming upstream, scanning the assembled patrons for Danielle. She'd said she usually started work at 11, but there was always the chance she'd stop at the bar first to have a drink. There was no sign of her at all, but I did see Berlin on her way to the dance floor. She was wearing a short black skirt and a red satin top with spaghetti straps. Her hair was slightly too short for the topknot she affected, so that more seemed to hang down than was secured above. Her earrings were big double rhinestone hoops that glittered and bounced against her neck as she moved. At first I thought she was unaccompanied, but then I saw a fellow pushing through the crowd in front of her. The other bobbing dancers closed around her and she was gone. I made my way back to the front door and checked the parking lot without luck. I fired up the VW and cruised the neighborhood, pausing at all the street corners where the hookers hung out. 10 more minutes of this shit and I was heading home. Finally, I pulled in at the curb, leaned over, and rolled my window down. A rail-thin brunette wearing a T-shirt, miniskirt, and cowboy boots separated herself from the wall she was leaning on. She ambled over and opened the door on the passenger side. I could see the puckering of goosebumps on her frail, bare arms. "You want company?" She was strung out on something, throwing off that odd, crackhead body odor. Her eyes kept sliding upward out of focus, like the roll on a TV picture. "I'm looking for Danielle." "Well, hon, Danielle's busy, so I'm covering her act. What you want, I can get, and that's an actual fact."
"Did she go home?"
"It's possible that Danielle has gone back to her place. Give me $10 more and I'll sit on your face."
I said, "Rhyming, very nice. Meter's a little off, but otherwise you're Longfellow."
"Baby, don't be strange. You got any change?"
"I'm fresh out," I said.
"I won't pout."
She pushed away from the car and sauntered back to her post. I pulled away, hoping I hadn't unleashed a fit of iambic pentameter. It hadn't occurred to me that Danielle might hang out at her place before going to work. I headed up two blocks and hung a left, turning into the narrow alleyway where Danielle had her digs. I pulled even with the property and peered through the gap in the shrubs, my gaze moving up the brick wall that led to her door. Her curtains had been drawn, but I could see the glow of lights on inside. I really had no idea whether she brought John's back to her place or not. It was close enough to the palace to be practical, but there were also a couple of fleabag hotels in the area, and she might have preferred to take her business there. I saw a shadow pass the window, which seemed to suggest she was on her feet. My car engine chuffed noisily, headlights slicing through the dark like blades. I could feel myself vacillate. She might be alone and glad of company. On the other hand, she might be occupied. I really didn't want to see her in a business context. While I debated, I killed the engine and flicked out my headlights. The alley disappeared in pitch blackness, night insects churring in the heavy silence. Within a minute, my eyes were accustomed to the dark, and the landscape began to reassemble itself in shades of charcoal. I got out of the car and locked it behind me. Maybe I'd knock once. If she was busy, so be it. I felt my way from the alley to the brick walk, holding one hand in front of me lest I stumble over trash cans. I reached her doorstep and cocked my head, listening for the sound of voices or canned laughter from the television. I gave a tentative knock. From the other side of the door, I heard low moans, sensuous and repetitive. Uh-oh. I remembered the first trailer I'd moved into after the death of my aunt. Coming in late one summer night, I'd heard a pregnant neighbor woman making sounds like that. Ever the good citizen, I'd gone over to her window, where I'd tapped and asked if she needed help. I thought she was in labor, realizing too late the process I'd interrupted was the one that made babies, not delivered them. Behind me, someone moved out of the shadows near the alley and eased through the shrubs. Leisurely footsteps scritched on the pavement and gradually faded. Danielle's moaning was renewed, and I backed up a step.
I stared out at the alleyway with puzzlement. Was that her John I'd just seen? I leaned my head against the door. Danielle? No response. I knocked again. Silence. I tried the knob. The hinges made no sound at all as the door swung inward. At first, all I saw was the blood. Chapter 16. The emergency room at St. Terry's was bedlam, a glimpse into purgatory. There had been a 6-car accident on the highway, and all of the examining rooms were filled with the injured and dying. In each cubicle, against the hot white cloth of the surrounding screens, I could see a shadow play of medical procedures against a backdrop of supply carts, wall-mounted oxygen, the hanging bags of blood and glucose, X-ray machinery. Once in a while, the low hum of activity would be cut by hellish shrieks from the patient on the gurney. On one stretcher, unattended, the victim writhed as if licked by flames, crying, "Mercy! Have mercy!" An orderly came by and moved him into a newly vacated examining room. Doctors, nurses, and med techs had been mustered from every corner of St. Terry's. I watched them work in perfect concert, actions urgent and precise. What the medical soap operas on TV conveniently omit is all the pain and the puke, body functions gone bad, needles piercing flesh, the bruises and the trembling, the low cries for help. Who wants to sit there and stare at real life? We want all the drama of hospitals without the underlying anguish. In the waiting room, the faces of the relatives who'd been notified of the collision were gray and haggard. They spoke in hushed voices, family members huddled in small groups, their postures bent with dread. Two women clung together, weeping hopelessly. On the other side of the glass doors, at one end of the parking lot, the nicotine addicts had collected in a cloud of cigarette smoke. I'd seen Serena Bonney soon after Danielle was brought in, but she'd been swallowed up by the commotion. When I'd first pushed open Danielle's front door, she was lying on the floor naked, her face as pink and pulpy as seedless watermelon. Blood spurted from a jagged laceration in her scalp, and she moved her limbs aimlessly, as if she might crawl away from her own internal injuries. I disconnected my emotions, doing what I could to stem the bleeding while I grabbed the phone off her bed table. The 911 dispatcher had alerted a patrol car and an ambulance, both of which arrived within minutes. Two paramedics had gone to work administering whatever first aid they could. The bruises on her body formed a pattern of dark, overlapping lines that suggested she'd been pounded with a blunt instrument. The weapon turned out to be a rag-wrapped length of lead pipe that her assailant had tossed in the bushes on his way out. The patrol officer had spotted it when he arrived and left it for bagging by the crime scene investigators, who showed up shortly afterward. Once the officer secured the scene, we moved out onto the small front porch, standing in a shallow pool of light while he questioned me, taking notes. By then, the alleyway was choked with vehicles. A stutter of blue lights punctuated the darkness, the police radio contributing a deadpan staccato murmur broken up by rasping intervals of static. A clutch of neighbors had assembled in the side yard in a motley assortment of sockless jogging shoes, bedroom slippers, coats, and ski jackets pulled on over nightclothes. The patrol officer began to canvass the crowd, checking to see if there were any other witnesses aside from me. A sporty, bright red Mazda pulled up in the alley with a chirp of tires. Cheney Phillips emerged and strode up the walk. He acknowledged my presence and then exchanged brief words with the uniformed officer, identifying himself before he moved into Danielle's cottage. I saw him halt on the threshold and back up a step. From the open door, he did a slow survey of the bloody scene, as if clicking off a sequence of time-lapse photographs. I imagined the view as I had seen it, the rumpled bedding, furniture knocked sideways and toppled. In the meantime, Danielle had been wrapped in blankets and shifted onto the gurney. I stepped aside for the paramedics as they brought her through the front door. I made eye contact with the older of the two. "Mind if I ride along?"
"Fine with me, as long as the detective doesn't object."
Cheney caught the exchange between us and gave a nod of assent.
"Catch you later," he said.
The gurney was eased into the back of the ambulance. I left my car where it was, parked to one side of the alley behind Danielle's house.
I sat beside her blanket-covered form in the rear of the ambulance, trying to stay out of range of the young paramedic who continued to monitor her vital signs. Her eyes were bruised and as swollen as a newly hatched bird's. From time to time I could see her stir, blind with pain and confusion. I kept saying, "You're going to be okay. You're fine. It's over." I wasn't even sure she heard me, but I had to hope the reassurances were getting through. She was barely conscious. The flashing yellow lights were reflected in the plate glass storefronts as we sped up State Street. The siren seemed somehow disassociated from events. At that hour of the night, the streets were largely empty, and the journey was accomplished with remarkable dispatch. It was not until we reached the emergency room that we heard about the multicar wreck out on 101. I sat out in the waiting room for an hour while they worked on her. By then, most of the accident victims had been tended to, and the place was clearing out. I found myself leafing through the same Family Circle magazine I'd read before, same perfect women with the same perfect teeth. The July issue was looking dog-eared. Certain articles had been torn out, and someone had annotated the article on male menopause, penning rude comments in the margin. I read busy day recipes for backyard barbecues, a column of reader suggestions for solving various parental dilemmas involving their children's lying, stealing, and their inability to read. Gave me a lot of faith in the generation coming up. Cheney Phillips walked in. His dark hair was as curly as a standard poodle's, and I noticed that he was impeccably dressed. Chinos and sport coat over an immaculate white dress shirt, dark socks, and penny loafers. He moved to the reception desk and flipped out his badge, identifying himself to the clerk, who was frantically typing up admissions forms. She made a quick phone call. I watched while he followed her into the treatment room where I'd seen them take Danielle. Moments later, he stepped out into the corridor, again in conversation with one of the ER doctors. Two orderlies emerged, maneuvering a rolling gurney between them. Danielle's head was swaddled in bandages. Cheney's expression was neutral as she was rolled away. The doctor disappeared into the next cubicle. Cheney glanced up and saw me. He came out into the waiting room and took a seat next to me on the blue tweed couch. He reached for my hand and laced his fingers through mine. "How's she doing?" I asked.
"They're taking her up to surgery. Doctor's worried about internal bleeding. I guess the guy kicked the shit out of her as a parting gesture. She's got a broken jaw, cracked ribs, damage to her spleen, and God knows what else. Doctor says she's a mess."
"She looked awful," I said. Belatedly, I could feel the blood drain away from my brain. Clamminess and nausea filled me up like a well. Ordinarily, I'm not squeamish, but Danielle was a friend, and I'd seen the damage. Hearing her injuries catalogued was too vivid a reminder of the suffering I'd witnessed. I put my head down between my knees until the roaring ceased. This was the second time I'd found myself fading, and I knew I needed help. Cheney watched with concern.
"You want to go find a Coke or a cup of coffee? It'll probably be an hour before we hear anything."
"I can't leave. I want to be here when she comes out of surgery."
"Cafeteria's down the hall. I'll tell the nurse where we are, and she can come get us if we're not back by then."
"All right. But make sure Serena knows. I saw her back there a little while ago." The cafeteria had closed at 10, but we found a row of vending machines that dispensed sandwiches, yogurts, fresh fruit, ice cream, and hot and cold drinks. Cheney bought two cans of Pepsi, two ham and cheese sandwiches on rye, and two pieces of cherry pie on styrofoam plates. I sat numbly at an empty table in a little alcove off to one side. He came back with a tray loaded down with the food, straws, napkins, plastic cutlery, paper packets of salt and pepper, and pouches of pickle relish, mustard, ketchup, and mayonnaise.
"I hope you're hungry," he said.
He began to set the table, arranging condiments on matching paper napkins in front of us.
"Seems like I just ate, but why not?" I said. "You can't pass this up."
"Such a feast," I said, smiling. I was too tired to lift a finger. Feeling like a kid, I watched while he unwrapped the sandwiches and began to doctor them.
"We have to make these really disgusting," he said.
"Why?"
"Because then we won't notice how bland they are."
He tore at plastic packets with his teeth, squeezing gobs of bright red and yellow across the meat. Salt, pepper, and smears of mayonnaise with a scattering of relish.
"You want to tell me about it?" he said, idly, while he worked.
He popped the lid on a can of Pepsi and passed an amended sandwich to me.
"Eat that. No arguments."
"Who can resist?" I bit into the sandwich, nearly weeping. It tasted so good. I moaned, shifting the bite to my cheek so I could talk while I was eating.
"I saw Danielle last night. We had dinner together at my place. I told her then I might see her tonight, but I really went by on a whim," I said.
I put a hand against my mouth, swallowing, and then took a sip of Pepsi.
I didn't know if she had company, so I sat there in the car with the engine running, checking it out. I could see she had her lights on, so I finally decided to go knock on her door. Worst-case scenario, she'd be with some guy and I'd tiptoe away.
"He probably saw your headlights."
Cheney had eaten half his sandwich in about 3 bites.
"Our moms would kill us if they saw us eating this fast."
I was bolting food down the same as he was. "I can't help it. It's delicious."
"Anyway, keep talking. I didn't mean to interrupt."
I paused to wipe my mouth on a paper napkin. "He must have heard me, if nothing else. That car makes a racket like a power mower half the time."
"Did you actually see him leaving her place?"
I shook my head. I only caught a glimpse of him as he was walking away. By then I was on the porch and I could hear her moan. I thought she was entertaining from the sound she made, like I'd caught her in the throes of passion, maybe faking it for effect. When I saw the guy out in the alley, it occurred to me something was off. I didn't know what it was. On the face of it, there was no reason to think he was connected to her, but it seemed odd somehow. That's when I tried the knob.
"He probably would have killed her if you hadn't showed."
"Oh, geez, don't say that. I was this close to leaving when I spotted him."
"What about a description? Big guy, little?"
"Can't help you there. I only saw him for a second, and it was largely in the dark."
"You're sure it was a man?"
"Well, I couldn't swear to it in court, but if you're asking what I thought at the time, I'd say yes. A woman doesn't usually whack another woman with a lead pipe," I said. "He was white, I know that."
"What else?"
"Dark clothes, and I'm sure he was wearing hard shoes because I heard his soles scratching on the pavement as he walked away. He was cool about it, too. He didn't run. Nice, leisurely pace, like he was just out for a stroll."
"How do you know he wasn't?"
I thought about it briefly. "I think because he didn't look at me. Even in the dark, people are aware of each other. I sure spotted him. In a situation like that, someone looks at you, you turn and look at them. I notice it most when I'm out on the highway. If I stare at another driver, it seems to catch their attention, and they turn and stare back. He kept his face to the front, but I'm sure he knew I was watching." Cheney hunched over his plate and started in on his pie.
"We had a couple of cars cruise the area shortly after the call came in, but there was no sign of him."
"He might live somewhere down there."
"Or had his car parked nearby," he said. "Did she say she had a date tonight?"
"She didn't mention an appointment." "Could have been Lester, come to think of it. She said he'd been in a foul mood, whatever that consists of." The pie was the type I remembered from grade school, a perfect blend of cherry glue and pink shriveled fruit, with a papery crust that nearly broke the tines off the fork. The first bite was the best. The pie point.
"Hard to picture Lester doing something like this. If she's beat up, she can't work. Mr. Dickhead's all business. He wouldn't tamper with his girls. More likely a John."
"You think she pissed some guy off?" Cheney gave me a look.
"This wasn't spur of the moment. This guy went prepared, with a pipe already wrapped to hide his fingerprints."
I finished my pie and ran the fork around the surface of the styrofoam plate. I watched the red of the cherry pie filling ooze across the tines of the plastic fork. I was thinking about the goons in the limousine, wondering if I should mention them to Cheney. I'd been warned not to tell him, but suppose it was them. I really couldn't see the motivation from their perspective. Why would an attorney from Los Angeles want to kill a local hooker? If he was so crazy about Lorna, why beat the life out of her best friend?
Cheney said, "What?"
"I'm wondering if this is related to my investigation."
"Could be, I guess.
We'll never know unless we catch him.
He began to gather crumpled napkins and empty Pepsi cans, piling empty plastic packets on the tray. Distracted, I pitched in, cleaning off the tabletop. When we got back to the emergency room, Serena called the OR and had a chat with one of the surgical nurses. Even eavesdropping, I couldn't pick up any information.
You might as well go on home, she said. Danielle's still in surgery, and once she comes out, she'll be in the recovery room for another hour. After that, they'll take her to intensive care.
Will they let me see her? I asked.
They may, but I doubt it. You're not a relative.
How bad is she?
Apparently she's stable, but they're not going to know much until the surgeon gets finished. He's the one to give you the details, but it's going to be a while yet.
Cheney was watching me.
I can run you home if you like.
I'd rather stick around here than go home, I said. I'll be fine if you want to go. Honest, you don't have to babysit.
I don't mind. I got nothing better at this hour anyway. Maybe we can find a couch somewhere and let you grab a nap.
Serena suggested the little waiting room off ICU, which was where we ended up. Cheney sat and read a magazine while I curled up on a sofa slightly shorter than I was. There was something soothing about the snap of paper as he turned the pages, the occasional clearing of his throat. Sleep came down like a weight pressing me to the couch. When I woke, the room was empty, but Cheney draped his sport coat across my upper body, so I didn't think he'd gone far. I could feel the silky lining on his jacket, which smelled of expensive aftershave. I checked the clock on the wall. It was 3:35. I lay there for a moment, wondering if there was some way to stay where I was, feeling warm and safe. I could learn to live on a waiting room couch, have meals brought in, tend to personal hygiene in the ladies' room down the hall. It'd be cheaper than paying rent, and if something happened to me, I'd be within range of medical assistance. From the corridor, I heard footsteps and the murmur of male voices. Cheney appeared in the doorway, leaning against the frame.
Ah, you're back. You want to see Danielle?
I sat up. Is she awake?
Not really. They just brought her down from surgery. She's still groggy, but she's been admitted to ICU. I told the charge nurse you're a vice detective and need to identify a witness.
I pressed my fingers against my eyes and rubbed my face. I ran my hands through my hair, realizing that for once, because of Danielle's cutting skills, every strand wasn't standing straight up on end. I gathered my resources and let out a big breath, willing myself back to wakefulness. I pushed myself to my feet and brushed some of the wrinkles out of my turtleneck. One thing about casual dressing, you always look about the same. Even sleeping in a pair of blue jeans doesn't have much effect. From the corridor, we used the house phone to call into the ICU nurse's station. Cheney handled the formalities and got us both buzzed in. Am I supposed to have a badge? I murmured to him as we moved down the corridor.
Don't worry about it. I told him you're working undercover as a bag lady.
I gave him a little push. We waited outside Danielle's room, watching through the glass window while a nurse checked her blood pressure and adjusted the drip on her IV. Like the layout in the cardiac care unit, these rooms formed a U-shape around the nurse's station, patients clearly visible for constant monitoring. Cheney had chatted with the doctor, and he conveyed the gist of her current situation.
He took her spleen out. Orthopedic surgeon did most of the work, as it turns out. Set her jaw, set her collarbone, taped her ribs. She had 2 broken fingers, a lot of bruising. She should be all right, but it's going to take a while. The cut on her scalp turned out to be the least of it. Mild concussion, lots of blood. I've done that myself. Bang your head on the medicine cabinet. It looks like you're bleeding to death.
The nurse straightened Danielle's covers and came out of the room.
2 minutes, she said, lifted fingers forming a V.
We stood side by side in silence, looking down at her like parents taking in the sight of a newborn baby. Hard to believe she belonged to us. She was nearly unrecognizable, her eyes blackened, jaw puffy, her nose packed and taped. One splinted hand lay outside the covers. All of her bright red acrylic nails had popped off or broken, and it made her poor swollen fingers look bloody at the tips. The rest of her was scarcely more than a child-sized mound. She was drifting in and out, never sufficiently alert to be aware of us. She seemed diminished by machinery, but there was something reassuring about all the personnel and equipment. As battered as she was, this was where she needed to be. Leaving ICU, Cheney put his arm around my shoulders.
You okay?
I leaned my head against him briefly. I'm fine. How about you?
Doing okay, he said.
He pressed the down arrow for the elevator.
I had the doctor leave orders. They won't give out any information about her condition, and no one gets in.
You think the guy would come back?
It looks like he tried to kill her once. Who knows how serious he is about finishing the job?
I feel guilty, like this is somehow connected to Lorna's death, I said.
You want to fill me in?
On what? The elevators opened. We stepped in, and Cheney pressed one. We began to descend.
The piece you haven't told me. You're holding something back, are you not?
His tone was light, but his gaze was intent. I guess I am, I said. I gave a quick sketch of my conversation in the limousine with a Los Angeles attorney and his sidekicks. As we emerged from the elevator, I said, You have any idea who the guy could be? He said he represented someone else, but he might have been talking about himself.
I can ask around. I know those guys come up here for R&R. Give me the phone number and I'll check it out.
I'd rather not, I said. The less I know, the better. Are they running prostitutes up here?
Maybe something minor. Nothing big time. They probably control local action, but that may not mean much more than skimming off the profits. Leave the nuts and bolts to the guys under them.
Cheney had parked on a side street, closer to the front entrance than the emergency room.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
Cheney had parked on a side street, closer to the front entrance than the emergency room. We reached the lobby. The gift shop and the coffee shop were both closed, shadowy interiors visible through plate glass windows. At the main desk, a man was engaged in an agitated conversation with the patient information clerk. Cheney's manner underwent a change, his posture shifting into cop mode. His expression became implacable, and his walk took on a hint of swagger. In one smooth motion, he flipped his badge toward the clerk, his gaze pinned on the fellow giving her such grief.
"Hello, Lester. You want to step over here? We can have a chat," he said.
Lester Dudley modified his own behavior correspondingly. He lost his bullying manner and smiled ingratiatingly.
"Hey, Phillips, nice to see you. Thought I caught sight of you earlier down around Danielle's place. You hear what happened?" "That's what I'm doing here. Otherwise, you wouldn't see me." "This is my night off. I was home watching TV when the dispatcher rang through." "Not alone, I hope. I hate to see a guy like you lonely. Offer still stands, day or night, male or female. Anything you got a taste for, Lester Dudley provides." "You pandering, Lester?" "I was just teasing, Phillips. Jesus, can't a guy make a little joke? I know the law as well as you do. Probably better if it comes right down to it."
Lester Dudley didn't suit my mental image of a pimp. From a distance, he had looked like a surly adolescent, too young to be admitted to an R-rated movie without a parent or guardian. Up close, I had to place him in his early 40s, a flyweight, maybe 5'4". His hair was dark and straight, slicked back away from his face. He had small eyes, a big nose, and a slightly receding chin. His neck was thin, making his head look like a turnip. Cheney didn't bother to introduce us, but Lester seemed aware of me, blinking at me slyly like an earth-burrowing creature suddenly hauled into daylight. He wore kid's clothes, a long-sleeved cotton-knit T-shirt with horizontal stripes, blue jeans, denim jacket, and keds. He had his arms crossed, hands tucked into his armpits. His watch was a Breitling, probably a fake, riddled with dials and far too big for his wrist. It looked more like something he might have acquired sending off box tops.
"So, how's Danielle doing? I couldn't get a straight answer from the broad at the desk."
Cheney's pager went off. He checked the number on the face of it.
"Shit.
I'll be right back, he murmured.
Lester seemed to bounce on his heels, ill at ease, staring after Cheney as he moved over to the desk. I thought I ought to break the ice. You're Danielle's personal manager.
That's right. Lester Dudley, he said, holding out his hand.
I shook hands with him, despite my reluctance to make physical contact.
Kinsey Milhone, I said. I'm a friend of hers.
When you need information, you can't afford to let personal repugnance stand in your way.
He was saying, Clerk's giving me a hard time, wouldn't give me information even after I explained who I was. Probably one of those women's liberation types.
No doubt.
How's she doing? Poor kid, I heard she really got the shit kicked out of her. Some crackaholic probably did it. They're mean sons of bitches.
The doctor left before I had a chance to talk to him, I said. Maybe the clerk was under orders not to give out information.
Hey, not her. She was having way too much fun, enjoying herself at my expense. Not that it bothers me. I'm always taking flack from these women's liber types. Can you believe they're still around? I thought they gave it up by now, but no such luck. Here just last week, this bunch of ballbusters came down on me like a ton of bricks, claimed I was engaged in white slavery. Do you believe that? What a crock. How can they be talking about white slavery when half my girls are black?
You're being too literal. I think you missed the point, I said.
Here's the point, he said. These girls make good money. We're talking big bucks, mega dollars. Where are these girls going to get employment opportunities like this? They got no education. Half of them's got IQs in double digits. You don't hear them whining. Do they complain? No way. They're living like queens. I'll tell you something else. This bunch of ballbusters isn't offering a damn thing. No jobs, no training, not even public assistance. How concerned could they be? These girls have to earn a living. You want to hear what I told them? I said, ladies, this is business. I don't create the market. It's supply and demand. Girls provide goods and services, and that's all it is. You think they care? You know what it's about. Sexual repression. Male-bashing bunch of fuzz-bumpers. They hate guys, hate to see anyone get their jollies with the opposite sex.
Or, I said, they might object to the idea of anyone exploiting young girls. Just a wild guess on my part.
Well, if that's their position, what's the beef? He asked. I feel the same way as them. But they treat me like the enemy. That's what I don't get. My girls are clean and well-protected, and that's the truth.
Danielle was protected?
Of course not, he said, exasperated that I was being so dense. She should have listened to me. I told her, don't take guys home. I told her, don't do a guy without I'm outside the door. That's my job. This is how I earn my percentage. I drive her when she goes on appointments. No crazy's going to lay a hand on her if she's got an escort, for cripe's sake. She don't call, I can't help. It's as simple as that.
Maybe it's time she got out of the life, I said.
That's what she's saying, and I go, hey, that's up to you. Nobody forces